the age of so-called personalized oncology, an interesting effort exists in lung cancer to predict response to chemotherapy specifically related to two molecular markers, ERCC1 and RRM1. I met with Dr. George Simon for an update of this work and other developments in the field, and he began by commenting on research he presented at the recent World Lung Congress, or ISLAC, meeting.
At the Moffitt Cancer Center, we completed four phase two studies. They kind of ran parallelly, almost parallelly. One of the four studies was the Molecular Analysis Directed Individualized Therapy Trial, which we reported separately, and used tailored chemotherapy based on two molecular markers, ERCC1 and RRM1. So patients with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer, where we did tumor biopsies and measured these genes and then tailored chemotherapy based on the expression levels of these genes. ERCC1 predicts for platinum sensitivity or resistance, and RRM1 predicts for gemcitabine sensitivity or resistance. Based on that, patients were assigned four different regimens: carboplatin gemcitabine, carboplatin docetaxel, gem docetaxel, and docetaxel vinorelbine. The other three studies were just standard phase two studies that looked at different combinations. The first phase two study was the oldest phase two study that just gave carbo-gem followed by docetaxel. This was prior to erlotinib and pemetrexed became available. Subsequent phase two, two other phase two studies, one of them looked at docetaxel and gefitinib in combination in elderly patients, and the other one looked at carboplatin taxol and atrasentan, which is an endothelin A inhibitor, kind of has got anti-angiogenesis function. After these four phase two studies were completed and reported and published, earlier this year what we did was what's called an individual patient analysis. We went back and called these patients, updated their survival, progression-free survival, and overall survival. And then we divided the entire data set of all the four studies, patients in all the four studies, into the personalized therapy group, the group that made it, and the other three studies we clumped together and called it the standard therapy group. Now the total N is 186 patients, and 58 of those patients made it, was on the personalized therapy group. Now this was actually treated like an intent to treat analysis. That means if you were on the study, you were considered on the study. Now, out of the 58 patients and on made it, only 55 actually got the assigned treatment. But nevertheless, they were all clumped together and made it and treated as if they were on made it. What I found was that now we have approximately 4 years worth of follow-up data going up to 48 months. And what I found was that patients who got the personalized therapy group had a better overall survival, with a median survival slightly in excess of 12 months, whereas the patients on the other three studies, when they were pooled together, had a median survival of 8 months. What was surprising to me was that these survival curves seemed to stay separate and plateau at a higher level. Remember, the chemotherapy was given only for 4 cycles. And the median number of cycles in both the personalized therapy group arm and the standard therapy group arm was 4 cycles. Essentially, most of these patients were done with chemo in 4 to 6 months. And there was a plateau in both the curves, the standard therapy group plateauing at about 10 to 15%, the personalized therapy group plateauing around 25%. The differences when we ran were statistically significant. We also did Kaplan-Meier analysis for survival. We also did multivariate and univariate analysis, both for progression-free survival and overall survival. And what we found was that getting personalized therapy was an independent predictor of improved survival, both for progression-free survival as well as for overall survival. It was what I hypothesized at the International Association of the Study of Lung Cancer meeting in San Francisco, the fact that it was puzzling to me that the curves remained separate and there was a higher plateau for the personalized therapy group, given the fact that the patients only got chemotherapy for 4 cycles. So technically speaking, what I would have expected to see actually was about a year or 2 years down the road, I expected both the curves to converge, but they did not. So we hypothesized at the meeting that When you give patients with low ERCC1 platinum-based chemotherapy, you kill off most of the cells or all the cells that have low ERCC1, but the cells that survive are forced to adapt to exposure to platinum and consequently have to upregulate their ERCC1 in order to survive. Similarly, patients with low RRM1 who are exposed to gemcitabine have to upregulate their RRM1 in order to survive the onslaught of gemcitabine-based chemotherapy. We and others have also shown that patients with high ERCC1 and high RRM1, though they may not respond to platinum or gemcitabine, they have a more indolent behavior. They are less aggressive. And in early-stage disease, we have shown that patients with high ERCC1 and high RRM1 who are resected for cure have a lower probability of recurrence. So we hypothesize, therefore, that when we treat them, when we expose them to chemotherapy based on ERCC1 and RRM1, we are forcing them to upregulate these markers and consequently adopt a more indolent behavior pattern, which can then explain the separation of those curves at the tail end of the curve, well after we have concluded chemotherapy treatments.
That's really interesting. I'm curious what kind of reaction you got to these data. I guess one obvious thing is that it's an indirect comparison. I don't know whether people brought that up as an issue, or how did people respond to what you presented?
So it is a hypothesis. It is not confirmatory. And that was brought up, and that's a very valid criticism of this analysis. We need to confirm this. And the only way we can confirm it is actually to do serial biopsies. And as you know, doing serial biopsies in stage 4 lung cancer patients, non-small cell lung cancer patients, is practically difficult. So what we are now looking at is actually to study these genes and how they change in exposure to the relevant chemotherapy in circulating tumor cells. And so my group is working towards trying to figure out whether we can measure these genes in circulating tumor cells before and after and subsequent to exposure to these chemotherapy. But these are in very preliminary stages, and there are a lot of technical difficulties associated with extracting circulating tumor cells from lung cancer patients and then measuring these cells for specific genetic markers.
Overall, what fraction of patients, for example, have low ERCC1?
So generally speaking, low ERCC1 by RT-PCR is defined as lower than a cohort median. So by definition, about half, 50% of the patients will be low and 50% of the patients will be high.
Interesting. Where are things right now in terms of ongoing studies looking at ERCC1 and RRM1?
So there are several studies ongoing in the United States as well as in Europe. In advanced stage disease, the molecular analysis-directed individualized therapy is being tested in a phase 3 trial. The patients are randomized to the customization arm in a 2:1 fashion. If they're randomized to the customization arm, they get chemotherapy based on the ERCC1 and RRM1 expression status. If they're randomized to the standard arm, they're all given carboplatin gemcitabine. This is a multi-center international phase 3 study that's currently accruing patients in multiple centers in the United States and also abroad, particularly Germany. There has already been a phase 3 study that was reported by the Spanish lung cancer study group working in cooperation with the group from UC Davis called the GILT trial, the Genotypic International Lung Trial. GILT actually looked at customizing chemotherapy based on ERCC1 and demonstrated a statistically significant improvement in response, but there was no differences in overall survival. There are also several adjuvant studies going around internationally. There is a Spanish study called the SCAT study that's actually tailoring adjuvant chemotherapy based on BRCA1 status, which is a repair gene like ERCC1. ERCC1 is a nucleotide excision repair gene, whereas BRCA1 is a mismatch repair gene. As you know, it's pretty significant in breast cancer and has treatment implications there.
Getting back to ERCC1, is that an assay, and for that matter, RMM1, is that an assay that clinicians, if they want to, can order in clinical practice?
Yes, there are several ways of measuring ERCC1 and RRM1. One of those techniques is using RT-PCR, where you actually measure expression by measuring RNA. You can also measure these by immunohistochemistry. And immunohistochemistry can be measured by standard approaches, where it's a little bit cruder, and you use the commonly used 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus by immunohistochemistry. Or you can do a more refined technique where you can do automated quantitative protein analysis by a technique called AQUA. Now, there are several companies that offer ERCC1 and RRM1 expression, and community physicians can order those.
I'm curious whether you ever look at or order that in a patient who's not on a study and consider it as part of non-protocol decision-making in your own practice.
In my own practice, we do it. And so I've not ordered it specifically for patient management yet. But we are actually currently designing protocols where instead of it being done at our center to ensure wider applicability of this technology, and that many of the principles that we have developed when we have done it applies to in a wider setting, we are thinking of using one of the commercial companies to measure ERCC1 and RRM1. But those protocols are currently under development.
Do you see the ERCC1 story as right now and a major clinical issue in terms of decision making, or more just trying to understand the disease better, but maybe it's not that practical clinically?
So the way I view the ERCC1 and RRM1 story is that it has been studied by multiple groups, both in the US and Europe. These multiple groups working independently have come to the same conclusion. And therefore, I think it is a valid story. I think before it can be widely applied, or before it should be widely applied, we should await the results of some of the ongoing phase 3 studies. If some of these ongoing phase 3 studies confirm the fact that giving tailored chemotherapy for advanced stage lung cancer based on ERCC1, RRM1 prolongs survival, and if some of the ongoing adjuvant studies confirm the fact that giving tailored adjuvant therapy based on ERCC1, RRM1 prolongs survival and also predict for improved response, improved survival, then I think they can and should be widely applied in our clinical decision making. But until the results of these phase 3 randomized studies are revealed, I think the technology itself remains investigational.
I guess my question is, does it look right now like it's really a major clinical difference? Or again, just more, you know, we can demonstrate it statistically, but maybe it's not that important clinically?
No, I think the clinical benefit from ERCC1, RRM1-based chemotherapy on advanced stage disease looks to be very similar to the improvement that we get with bevacizumab. And I would have to highlight the pharmacoeconomic significance here. You know, ERCC1, RRM1 testing may cost us $500. And by spending that $500 up front, if we are able to get a 3-4 month improvement in overall survival, I think that is a cost-effective way of improving overall survival. As in my analysis that I reported at the World Lung meeting, the difference in median survival was 8 months versus 12 months. That's a 4-month difference. If you look at the studies, particularly ECOG 4599, where bevacizumab was added to carboplatin, the improvement in survival was 2.5 months, 3 months in that range, 10 months to 12.6 months. So it's a 2-plus-month difference. To get the 2-month-plus difference, you have to spend $50,000, $60,000 worth of bevacizumab to enjoy that difference. So I think even if the improvement is a few months, it is actually an improvement that is very cost-effectively gained.
Any difference in terms of cis versus carbo in terms of ERCC1?
That has not been very critically looked at. I have looked at it in cell lines in my laboratory. And basically what I found was that carboplatin is particularly vulnerable to ERCC1-mediated resistance. Cisplatin seems to be less vulnerable. But these are unpublished observations based on cell line studies in my laboratory.
Now, how do you factor in, particularly in these trials that you describe, the issue of biologics? Are some of these patients that are going into these trials theoretically, for example, eligible for Bev? And then how do you deal with that? They just don't get it?
Yeah, so at our center, what we do is we do EGFR mutation status, and if they are EGFR mutation positive, we put them on erlotinib. If they're EGFR mutation negative, only then do we offer them the study. And bevacizumab story is evolving, and its benefit has essentially been shown only with a taxane. When you add bevacizumab to carboplatin, you do improve survival, as in 4599, but when bevacizumab was added to cisplatin and gemcitabine, it did not improve survival. And so we don't know whether adding bevacizumab to, say, cisplatin plus pemetrexed or carboplatin plus pemetrexed improves survival. We don't know that yet because those phase 3 randomized studies have not been done. In my opinion, and after having thought about this for a while, I am comfortable giving them a non-Bev-based regimen on this protocol, particularly because we are giving tailored treatment. And if these patients are Bev-eligible, we can always give it with second-line therapy.
So you had a phase 2 study that you were part of also at ISLEC, looking at bevacizumab and erlotinib as first-line therapy of people over the age of 70, which I thought was interesting. I see a lot of people in practice using that combination. I sort of wonder about it. It's pretty expensive. What did you look at in this study, and what were your thoughts about what you found?
Well, this study is still not complete. It's still accruing patients, and we just did a preliminary report. This enrolls elderly patients with a combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib as first-line treatment for patients who are 70 years of age and older. And the intent was to develop a non-chemotherapy regimen for elderly patients to see whether we can prolong life without taking away too much of its quality. And that was the intent of the design. The study was designed before the information about the strong association between EGFR mutation status and response to erlotinib was available. However, we've decided to continue accrual to the study till it finishes, and we are about 6 or 7 patients away from finishing.
Have you yourself observed, useful objective responses?
Actually, one of the first cases was actually a gentleman who had a dramatic response to this combination. We had sent the tissue for mutation analysis. We did not wait for it to come back. He was 75 years old and in good health.
Non-smoker?
A never smoking past. And he had a very good response to this combination. And subsequently, his mutation analysis came back positive.
I see it's your first case that you're going to present
yes.
here today. That's interesting. Any reason to think that adding in bevacizumab in a mutation positive patient might provide greater benefit than just erlotinib alone?
No particular reason. The response rates with erlotinib in mutation positive patients are very high, in the vicinity of 75%. And it remains to be seen whether adding bevacizumab to erlotinib in that setting would make a difference. The beta lung trial, which basically looked at in the second-line treatment of non-small cell lung cancer, adding bevacizumab to erlotinib versus erlotinib alone, was essentially negative. But this was for all patients, not just mutation-positive patients. So I don't know the answer to that question. Those studies remain to be done.
Do you think that that combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib is a reasonable non-protocol option to consider either upfront in an older patient or down the line?
I think that combination is maybe a reasonable upfront combination in a select group of elderly patients. But generally speaking, I would say no. There's no evidence that adding bevacizumab to erlotinib in mutation-positive patients adds any benefit. And I would not give erlotinib upfront in mutation-negative patients. And in that case, I would use chemotherapy. And you could then conceivably use bevacizumab in conjunction with carboplatin in that setting.
How do you use, if at all, erlotinib in mutation-negative patients? Second, third-line therapy or not at all?
So in mutation-negative patients, I may use erlotinib as maintenance, as in Saturn, in squamous cell carcinomas. So if the patient has squamous cell carcinoma and has had either carbogem or cisgem or carbotaxotere or carbotaxol, I may then consider adding erlotinib as maintenance based on Saturn. I may use erlotinib third line in mutation-negative squamous cell carcinoma patients after first and second-line patients.
Now, you mentioned that you're using mutation now, as a lot of people are, maybe related to the IPAS study, to determine first-line therapy. How long does it take you to get the results back?
Well, it depends on how quickly you can acquire the tissue. The testing itself can be done in a week's time, and essentially it takes about, in our center, we have the results in less than 2 weeks. Where the delay comes is when the patient has had a biopsy at another center, then comes to our center, then we have to acquire the tissue from the other center. And that can take anywhere between 1 week at the earliest, and sometimes have taken 5-6 weeks.
Hmm.
If the patient is symptomatic, then I don't wait, I treat. And if I treat without knowing the mutation status, I give them chemotherapy. If the patient is relatively asymptomatic, good performance status, and has got a high probability of having an EGFR mutation, like a never smoker or a remote smoker, adenocarcinoma, Asian female, then I wait and try to get the analysis done within 2 to 3 weeks.
I was curious what your thoughts are about the newer so-called irreversible EGFR TKIs. I know one is BIBW2992, I think it is. I think there's another one. What do we know about those agents in terms of how they work and what kinds of trials are looking at them right now?
So the specific compound you mentioned is BIBW2992. It's an irreversible HER1, HER2 inhibitor. Now, when a compound is irreversible, then that receptor is blocked. That particular receptor is blocked. For the cells to now survive, and if they are dependent on EGFR signaling, they have to make additional receptors. And that's why you still continue the reversible TKIs and give it in a continuous dosing schedule to continue to block the newer receptors that are being made. Generally speaking, they bind relatively tightly to these areas. And whether they're more effective than reversible TKIs given on a continuous basis is a question that, to my mind, is still unanswered at this point. Now, BIBW2992 is being evaluated in 3 studies right now. One of them is looking at it in EGFR mutation positive patients. In a phase 2 study, when it was given to a cohort of EGFR mutation positive patients, the response rate was approximately 95-97%. So now they are doing a randomized trial comparing BIBW2992 first line in EGFR mutations versus cisplatin pemetrexed. So this is a randomized phase 3 trial in EGFR mutation positive patients. It is also currently being evaluated in a cohort of patients who have failed erlotinib in the third line setting. So the patients have gotten chemo, have gotten erlotinib, have progressed or failed erlotinib, and then they are being randomized to BIBW2992 versus placebo. Now, there are other compounds, HKI-272, it's got a name now, it's called nilartinib, that appeared promising in initial phase 2 studies, but subsequent studies did not pan out, and actually further development of this compound has currently ceased. So to date, no irreversible inhibitor has been shown to be better than erlotinib or gefitinib in control trials. In cell lines, if you have a resistance mutation, particularly T790M mutation, T790 adds a bulky methionine group in the ATP binding pocket. And because that group is bulky, it sterically hinders the attachment of the TKI to the ATP binding pocket. And some of these irreversible inhibitors are able to bind even in the presence of the steric hindrance compounded by the presence of these resistance mutations, particularly T790M. And that is the theoretical advantage of drugs like BIBW2992 and HKI-272. However, in the clinic, these advantages need to be confirmed in studies to show benefit in patients.
What about the side effects here? Are they worse than with the regular reversible TKIs, or the same?
To the best of my knowledge, both BIBW2992 has the same, essentially very similar side effect profiles, with rash and diarrhea being the most common. And since head-to-head comparisons have not been done, it's difficult to discern whether these side effects are higher than erlotinib.
So your 74-year-old man who got put on this study, what's his current status?
He's actually doing very well. He had a very good partial response. He had diffuse infiltrates. He had bronchoalveolar carcinoma, multicentric, involving both lungs, all five lobes, extensive infiltrates. And he was short of breath. And after starting this combination, his infiltrates have decreased dramatically. And he's essentially asymptomatic. From the shortness of breath and his cancer symptoms, he has struggled a little bit with his rash, which we have taught him how to palliate. And once he's gotten a handle on that, he's actually done very well and continues to be on the study.
How long has he been on treatment?
For over 7 months now. And this last CAT scan continues to show improvement.
Any BEV issues, hypertension, nosebleeds?
Not with this gentleman.
Do you see many nosebleeds in lung cancer? Because we hear a lot of that in colon cancer and breast cancer, but I'm not so sure about lung cancer.
I've not seen very many nosebleeds. I have, but not very many. But the more common toxicities that I've run into is hypertension and proteinuria. We check proteins and we have had proteinuria and hypertension. Those are the two most common toxicities that I've run into. And of course, myelosuppression when combined with chemo, but that's expected anyway.
You mentioned rash, and I'm always interested in what people do about it. I'm curious what you do preventively, what you do therapeutically. And also, I didn't see this presentation, but I saw there was a presentation by Perez Soler looking at some kind of cream for the rash that had something in it. Do you know what he looked at?
Yes. So generally speaking, I think the key to managing a rash is being aggressive about it up front. So you tell the patient, the day you meet the patient, that rash is a problem, you're more likely to get it than not. And I advise the patients to moisturize their skin with a good moisturizer at least twice a day to keep their skin moist. I also advise them to protect themselves from the sun, wear long sleeve shirts and wear a hat. And then I teach them to differentiate between a pustular components and the maculopapular components. If the patient has significant clustering of maculopapular components, I advise them to apply a 1% hydrocortisone cream in addition to the moisturizer to the affected area. If they have a pustular component, then I may actually prescribe them a Cleosin ointment, an antibiotic cream, to apply to the areas where there is a pustular component. If that is the case, I generally like to see them back in clinic. Occasionally, if the rash is extensive and there's a lot of itching, I may give them a Medrol dose pack, a quick tapering dose of steroid, and sometimes interrupt the medication for about 7 to 10 days and then restart it. Generally speaking, most of my patients haven't been able to continue. Some of them have been able to continue with dose reduction, but rarely have I had to stop the treatment based on a rash. There are several investigative creams that are currently being evaluated. One of them applies a vitamin K derivative, and this is believed, to the best of my understanding, to reduce the inflammation at the corneum basalis, the basal layer of the skin, where you can often see neutrophilic infiltrate, which may be secondary to the EGFR being inhibited in that setting, in that layer of the skin. Other people are looking at actually giving the epidermal growth factor, EGF, the ligand of the EGFR. And what you do is you apply that to that area. And when the epidermal growth factor is applied in a cream form to the skin area, then you can increase signaling, at least in that particular area.
How do you get epidermal growth factor? That seems kind of strange. They synthesize it, or?
Yeah, it's a protein.
Wow, interesting.
But those are some of the ideas that have been circulated and are being looked at.
Why don't we talk about your second patient?
My second patient is a relatively healthy 65-year-old female, was a smoker, but a remote smoker, quit about 10, 15 years ago. Came with a fairly large lung mass in her left upper lobe and then had adrenal gland metastases, and she was completely asymptomatic. She had no weight loss, no change in her performance status, and no pain. She was picked up accidentally when she got a chest x-ray for some other purpose. She comes to us, we stage her. As part of her staging, we do a brain MRI and we find multiple small brain metastases. So we gave her whole brain radiation therapy to control her brain metastases. And then once her brain metastases was controlled and she was EGFR mutation negative, she was KRAS negative, I offered her standard treatment or made it, the phase 3 made it. She elected to enroll on made it. And she was asymptomatic, and it took us about 2 weeks to do the gene analysis. And she was customized to the carboplatin gemcitabine arm, and she's now taking treatment on that arm.
So she was, what, ERCC high and MRM1 low?
So I'm blinded to that. I still know. If the patient was given any other regimen, I would have known. Because all the patients in the standard arm get carbogem. Because the standard arm is only carbogem. But one of the four customization regimens in the made it arm is carbogem.
Wow, interesting.
So she's either randomized to the standard arm or has low ERCC1 and low RRM1 and therefore was given carbogem.
Interesting.
She has just received her second cycle.
What's your take on, because I guess, as you mentioned earlier, these patients, theoretically, a patient like this might have been eligible for bevacizumab. Of course, she had brain mets. What's your approach to using bevacizumab in patients who have brain mets?
I did not offer Bev because of her brain mets. And she is so young, healthy, and otherwise asymptomatic. I opted not to take that risk. However, there is a recently reported and now published study called Passport Trial. And in the Passport study, approximately 105 patients with treated brain metastases from non-small cell lung cancer were given bevacizumab, and it was found to be safe with no increased incidence of intracranial hemorrhage. Bev remains an option for her.
Now, you and your group also reported at ASCO a scoring system for patients with brain metastases. Can you talk about that and sort of where this patient would fit in there?
So this was a retrospective analysis that a fellow that was working with me, Dr. Mongley, did at the Moffitt Cancer Center. We wanted to look at clinical predictors of getting brain metastases. So we screened approximately 4,000 patients with adenocarcinomas and looked at those patients who had brain metastases, who never had brain metastases, who had brain metastases at diagnosis, and who had brain metastases as at a recurrence. And we tried to study the epidemiological characteristics of these patients and try to come up with a risk score. What we found was that the risks for getting brain metastases were patients who are less than 63 years of age were at a higher risk for getting brain metastases compared to patients who are more than 63 years of age. We also found that never smokers or light or remote smokers were at a higher risk for developing brain metastases compared to those who were heavy smokers. We also found, not surprisingly, that adenocarcinomas was at a higher risk for getting brain metastases compared to squamous cell carcinomas. This work has not been published, and the manuscript currently is being prepared for publication, but has been reported in abstract form both at ASCO and at the European Society of Thoracic Oncology meeting held in Lausanne, Switzerland last year. Interestingly, we also looked at the influence on survival of brain metastases. And what we found was that adenocarcinomas are more likely to have brain metastases, but if they do, they don't influence survival. If you're a stage 4 adeno with or without brain metastases, your survival was the same. However, if you're a squamous cell carcinoma, the probability of getting brain metastases was in the 10-11% range, whereas if an adeno, it was more like 30%. But if you had a squam and you got brain metastases, that did influence survival, and it had a detrimental effect on survival. So based on these characteristics, we have tried to come up with a scoring system, a clinical scoring system that would predict for who is at a high risk for brain metastases, and patients who are never smokers, who are less than 63 years of age, and who are adenos. We gave them a point scheme, and then 1 to 3 is low risk, 3 to 7 is high risk, and you could stratify risk from less than 3% to about 10 to 13% risk of getting a brain metastases. This work, I think, needs to be done in a validation cohort. Also, we are now thinking of coming up with some molecular predictors as well of brain metastases, but that's in very early stages.
Do you think there are any practical clinical implications to these data, for example, in terms of screening, MRIs?
It has practical clinical implications in terms of screening. I think in the United States, all patients do get brain MRI, or at least a CT scan of the brain is a staging procedure. I think the implications are not as much for staging, but maybe more for doing more targeted PCI studies, prophylactic cranial radiation therapy studies. And later on, we may be able to more accurately pinpoint who is at risk for getting brain metastases. Now, it may also save us some money down the road if we know that a certain subset of patients are very unlikely to get brain metastases. Then we can save the expense of doing a routine brain MRI or CT scan as part of the staging. But I think it may have more of an implication for a treatment like a PCI.
How about your last patient, the 62-year-old man?
So my last patient is a 62-year-old gentleman who had a T2N1 completely resected squamous cell carcinoma, had hilar nodes, but the mediastinum was properly staged with about 30 nodes taken out, and they were all negative. And the data suggests that he should get adjuvant chemotherapy. Currently, the standard is a platinum-based chemotherapy, and so I gave him cisplatin. And generally, most of the data are with either etoposide, as in the IALT study, or vinorelbine, as in the JBR10 and the ANITA studies. I sometimes tend to use a third-generation drug like Taxol or Taxotere or gemcitabine. This is a squame, so I did not give him pemetrexed. I opted to use docetaxel with the cisplatin for several reasons. Generally speaking, when I give adjuvant treatment, I do not want to leave them with toxicities that they could be living with for a long time. And hence, I refrain from using paclitaxel because the incidence of neuropathy can be as high as 50 to 60%. And you could live with a neuropathy for the next 5-10 years. Docetaxel has a much lower incidence of neuropathy, somewhere in the 14% range. And it's a fairly convenient regimen, day one, Q21. I tend to be a little bit more liberal with the use of prophylactic Neulasta in this setting. When you're treating adjuvant patients, at least my tolerance for risk is very low. Since docetaxel is a fairly myelosuppressive regimen, so I typically give them prophylactic Neulasta with cycle one. And once you do that, it's easy to get them through four cycles with Neulasta. The thrombocytopenia is generally not a problem. Hypersensitivity reactions are not a problem. Just because you're giving only four cycles, you don't tend to see a lot of capillary leak and nail changes, and you're able to get in, give the four cycles, and get out without too much side effects, which are chronic.
So you gave this man Neulasta?
I did. I did give him 75 of cisplatin with 75 docetaxel and gave him Neulasta. I do counsel them that they may get some bone pain and advise them to palliate that. But he tolerated the regimen generally well and is now out approximately a year from his surgery and is disease-free.
Now, are there any trials out there that he was eligible for or would be eligible for that you might have discussed? Theoretically, he would have been eligible for the adjuvant ECOG study looking at bevacizumab.
Yes. He was eligible for ECOG 1505, and he was offered that study, and he declined. He is a professor from one of the nearby universities, and he had read up on the drugs and bevacizumab and the side effects, and 1505 is open at our center, and to my mind, it's a high-priority study, and I would beseech the listeners to, if it's open at your centers, to accrue to this trial because it's an important question that we would like to answer. This gentleman was offered 1505, but he declined to participate.
Now, one of the things I've heard from lung cancer investigators that kind of surprises me a little bit about that study is concern about, you know, if they get randomized to bevacizumab, they get it for a year. Of course, in breast cancer, we do that all the time with trastuzumab and bevacizumab trials. But they verbalize, you know, the challenge of keeping a patient on for a year. Have you found it a challenge? Because, I mean, most patients, I guess, do pretty well once the chemo is stopped.
I agree. I think giving bevacizumab maintenance by itself is generally not an issue. I have run into some proteinuria, and for that, sometimes I had to skip a dose and wait for the proteinuria to come back down, and then I typically resume. Hypertension can be an issue, but generally is well managed by very conventionally and routinely used antihypertensive medications. So bevacizumab by itself, in my experience, is actually a well-tolerated drug, and I personally have not had a problem keeping them on Bev for a year or longer.
You said it was high priority. What do you think maybe we might see with this study, and any analogy to what was reported with colon cancer at the ASCO meeting from the NSABP, where they purported to show a decrease in recurrence while the Bev was on board, and then it kind of came back together. Do you think that's relevant at all to lung cancer? What do you think we're going to see with this ECOG lung trial?
Well, firstly, I think we need to accrue and finish the study. There are some important biomarker components to the study, and that also we learn from. Hopefully, in the future, we will be able to know who to give Bev to or who are the subset of patients who are likely to benefit from Bev and who are not. And I think in those aspects, the study is important. To specifically answer your question, will this improve overall survival? I think it'll improve disease-free survival. Overall survival, it's less certain, and it's a difficult benchmark to beat in lung cancer. And so I'm more optimistic that we'll have improved disease-free survival, whether it'll actually improve overall survival by giving the drug in a year or two for a year remains to be seen.